From the house doctor to the rock professor, today's groundbreakers are here on Radio Today.
Switch on to
1485 AM
Radio Today.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of A Place Called Melville. You're with Morale Imond and Alistair Graham. What have we got this week, Morale?
We've got our heritage program.
I knew that. You had to tell everyone.
We've got William Gould, and it's rather sad that we're speaking to him for the last time on A Place Called Melville.
Well, the last time in this current series of programs,
yes.
Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think he enjoys it now too. We used to have to coax him right in the beginning. He wasn't that keen, but I think he likes doing it now.
Well, certainly when we finished this last interview, he said, I've really enjoyed this.
I know, yeah.
So that was great to hear, and I think he will want to come back to
the stage. Well, we certainly value his information.
Oh, immensely. He's such a wealth of information. And with that, let's go and join him.
Oh, well, this is sort of sad in a way, kind of bittersweet. Now we're saying goodbye to William Gould with the end of our Place Called Melville series of programs. But we've got a nice program for you today, full of heritage things.
Yes, indeed, we have. We're still talking about the country club.
Yes, and we're here again.
That's right, here we are. And you'll remember that last time we mentioned the club was established by the Auckland Park Real Estate Company. The reason for that not being, you know, sort of public interest or anything, but simply that it was a business decision because this land had been purchased with the prospect of mining gold here. When they found there was no gold, well, what they thought there would be no gold. I believe there is gold.
Oh, really? Okay,
yeah.
William.
Well, I think if you look hard enough, you'll find it.
Under the rose bushes.
Possibly. But the point was that they decided there was no gold, and so they decided to turn Auckland Park and Brixton into residential areas. And they thought that if they... Well, remember I mentioned that there was a bit of a recession because the British Army had left after the Boer War.
Yep.
And Johannesburg was finding times a bit tough. And then they decided, well, the way to do this is to change this land into residential, and we will try to attract people to Auckland Park and Brixton by establishing a club, a sporting club.
Yes.
And you remember I told you that they offered a vast variety of sports, from hunting to clay pigeon shooting to gymkhanas to various things, and this actually had the desired effect. They got a number of important gentlemen in Johannesburg, including Dalrymple and Sandy Lands, who was the commander of the British Army, and also a Reverend, what was his name? I can't remember, from Parktown.
That's right. So.
They all came together, and they decided this was the way to go, and the club was established. And I spoke last time a little bit about the secretary's residence, which is an old still there. But unfortunately, what's happened to that is that the widening of the road, Kingsway, has come right up against the back of the house. The house is still standing in all its glory.
Yes.
I think it was originally with a shingled roof, but now it's Harvey tiles.
Yeah.
And another unfortunate thing about that is that they've built these huge buildings at the back, which they should never have been allowed to do. If a proper heritage impact assessment had been undertaken, they would have seen this is a heritage structure and it's got to be protected, and they wouldn't have allowed these looming buildings. Or they shouldn't have allowed. I'm not saying they wouldn't have. Money talks, as we know. But
in all sorts of ways.
Yeah, unfortunately. But the garden is very beautiful as well.
Yes.
And what I'd like to talk about firstly this morning is just another feature of the club, and that's what we'll be looking at today is several of the features of the club. One of those features is the original gate. on Stanley Avenue.
Yes.
I don't know if it's Stanley Avenue or Kingsway. I've never been able to, you know, determine.
Yeah, I'm also not too sure. I've got a funny feeling it's still Kingsway there.
Yeah, well, possibly. Mm. But the thing is, I think this was the original gate to the club, you know, the members' gate.
Lovely.
And it really was, is a beautiful structure. I mean, it's very much in the arts and crafts idiom as well.
Very much. And we hardly notice it nowadays.
No, you don't
you
notice
have to
it.
Look carefully. It's I love it. That's why I look for it. But
that's right. It's got these wonderful welcoming arms, you know, curved arms.
That's such a
out.
Lovely way of putting it. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And it's made of hammer-dressed stone, which means that, you know, they took a hammer and chisel and cut each stone exactly square and rectangular.
Gosh.
And then it's, the stone is mixed with a combination of tiles, Broseley tiles of different thicknesses to give detail.
Oh, really?
So it's really lovely. And, and then the lamp standards of iron. I think we're probably the work of George Ness, who was the iron smith that Baker favoured.
Oh, really? I was going to ask you, actually, if that was the Baker person.
Yeah, I wonder if that was. I mean, I'm not sure, but it looks like his work. And then also you've got these lovely teak gates, which are now in a pretty bad shape, but there they are. And they are hung by these large iron strap hinges, which are also the work, I think, of an ironsmith. If it wasn't Nest, it was somebody in his mould.
I think that guy that did the back stuff was pretty prolific, so I think there was probably one person who did a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting that, in fact, it was Johannesburg Heritage Foundation or Parktown Westcliff Heritage Trust then that actually marked his grave at Brixton Cemetery, because he had an unmarked grave, and in recognition of all the work that he did, they marked his grave, which I thought was quite a gracious thing to do.
Very.
Anyway, so that's the gate. It's there for all to see. You should go and have a look at it sometimes. It's
very
nice. Yeah. Okay, and then moving on from there, if we move a little bit across the car park, you'll come to the Garden of Remembrance, which is a very serene little area that they've set aside to commemorate the people, the members of the club who died in three conflicts, and those are the 1914-18 war, the Great War, then the Second World War, and then thirdly also the border conflicts in South Africa as well, which today, of course, is very something we like to sweep under the carpet. We don't want to commemorate people who died in that, unless they were on the correct side.
But they did die, so that's
right. Right, so that was the conflict of 1975-1989. It's a very quiet and dignified space, but I'm sorry to have to record that the beautiful pin oak that shaded the area has recently been cut down. For what reason, I really am at a loss to understand. It was a wonderful tree, and it's gone. But the fact is that while we're remembering those who did fall in those conflicts, we should just also think about the people, the living people who survived those conflicts and had something to say about it.
Yes.
And one of the anecdotes that I like to recall is that of a member by the name of Bond.
Oh, yeah.
And he fought in the First World War in the Transvaal Scottish, I think he was. No, he was in the Imperial Light Horse.
Okay.
And, you know, he was invalided out. He was wounded, invalided out, and he thought he had seen the last of army life. But this wasn't to be, because in 1922, of course, we had that great strike in Johannesburg.
Yeah.
And he was called up back into the ILH.
Oh.
And he was posted here to the country club, which was served as the temporary headquarters of the army during that conflict. And he was one day on guard duty out in Kingsway or Stanley Avenue, whatever it was. And, of course, if those of you remember the earlier times, Kingsway was lined by these beautiful blue gum trees, huge blue gum trees.
Yeah,
and he was
not so long ago.
Yeah, well, he was standing under one of those blue gum trees doing his guard duty when a bullet ricocheted from the ridge. You remember that the strikers were on the ridge and on the other side, south side of the ridge, and the British forces were this side. So presumably if a bullet ricocheted from the ridge, it was a British bullet, a government. Why did I say British? It was actually government of Smuts.
Yes.
Smuts's forces were firing up onto the ridge.
Right.
So presumably the bullet that ricocheted was a government bullet.
Uh-huh.
And it came whining past his head, 2 feet above his head, and lodged itself in the tree just above his head. But the thing was that quite a long time afterwards, he read in the press, when they were cutting down these blue gum trees, for whatever reason they did that, that the sword struck a bullet. And the report said this was probably a relic of the 1922 strike.
Yeah.
And Bond sort of laconically remarks at the end of this little tale, too true. He knew too well that bullet had been just above his head.
The reason he was still alive.
That's right. And then there was the other story is just a funny little thing. The secretary of the club at that time was a man who revelled in the name of Colonel Dawson Squibb.
Oh,
very
yes.
Much.
I know that name from Cape Town.
Do you?
Yeah.
Right. Well, Colonel Dawson Squibb also found himself back in uniform during the 1922 strike, but he found himself here at the country club as a private. So he had been demoted from colonel to private.
God.
I don't know how he ever lived that down.
Okay, well, let's come back in a few minutes.
This is a very well-known track by our own Bat, Paul Ditchfield, and the other Bats, from the album The Heart and Soul. And this track's
that's a novel way of introducing the Bats. Our own Bat.
Well, we own only one Bat.
And we're going to listen to?
It's Build Me Up Buttercup.
Switch on to
1485 AM Radio Today.
And that's where we are in the studio at Radio Today on a place called Melville with Morley and Alistair. Now let's, before the break we were talking to William, or rather he was explaining all sorts of things about the country club and more. Let's go and carry on with our conversation with him. Back for the second half.
Yep, it's next, William.
Yeah, well, people often wonder about accommodation at the club.
And, indeed.
And there's always
really
been
important.
A demand for accommodation.
There has, and there is a little bit.
People still want to come and stay here for a while. You know, I don't think they have permanent residences as they used to. But, as I say, always a demand. And in 1925, it was decided to erect an annex, which was originally called the Dormy House.
Oh, yes.
That beautiful house that is just at the back of the club.
Yeah.
Um, And then the name was changed recently. The name was changed to the Lodge for some strange reason again. But luckily, happily, it's been renamed the Dormy House.
Yeah, oh,
so it's
good.
Gone back, because I think there was a lot of agitation at this. So that's quite a good bit of news. But those who lived here in the early days have left a record of the experience. And the overwhelming impression seems to have been how inexpensive accommodation was.
Okay.
For example, there was a person who lived here for 50 years,
wow.
J.C. Merkin. And he, when he first came to live at the club, he lived in what was called a cowshed, which was just a structure down the bottom there,
which luckily
burnt down in 1931. He then moved to a bedroom in the main club, which is just above us where we were sitting here. Where the billiard room used to be, and where the card rooms were, and the committee rooms, and so on. So he had a bedroom there, and then they finally moved into the dormy house.
Oh yeah!
And he recalls that his tariff, was originally £12.10 per month, which is very, very reasonable. By 1962, obviously the prices had increased, but not by much. Accommodation consisting of bed and breakfast was advertised at £2 per night.
Wow.
That's 1962. If you consider some of the prices that we pay today. Just a brief note or just a brief remark on the architecture that we find here at the club. And of course there are different styles of architecture. If we look at the dormy house that we've just been talking about, of course that's very much in the Baker idiom, the arts and crafts style that Baker and his partners brought to Johannesburg and had such an impact in Johannesburg. And in fact in throughout South Africa as well.
Yeah, sort of grand version of the arts and crafts.
Yeah, well, if we talk about, for example, the Union Buildings, there's arts and crafts there because they use sandstone. And
very much so.
But, you know, I was thinking about Baker. He didn't really do too many public buildings. In Johannesburg, it was the South African Institute of Medical Research, I think it's called, up on Hospital Hill. That was one of them. But there were churches, of course, but not so many public buildings. Domestic architecture,
But in the Cape as well, those little ones.
Anyway, so that's arts and crafts, and we see it in other buildings. It's not just the dormy house. We see it in the bell-cast eaves on the roofs, the shingled roofs, the bell-cast eaves and the wooden windows, small windows flush with the wall. All these are arts and crafts elements. But then we've also got the Victorian the Edwardian architecture, and we see that particularly in the old squash courts, the red brick squash courts, which incidentally, I just wanted to remark, not only in the squash courts, but also in the domestic quarters to the south of the property as well.
Yeah.
One of the ways in which they controlled the sort of temperature in those buildings was a very ingenious device where they had pitched roofs, but the apex of the roof did not meet exactly. There's about an 18-inch gap there. And this was covered by a curved corrugated iron, like half barrel thing, running along the apex of the roof. And this allows the air to come in at the bottom and be drawn out through there. And it actually is very effective. They've got them in the old squash courts as well. If you go in there on the hottest day, it's quite cool. It's amazingly cool.
Yeah.
So, yes, we've got that. We've got the Edwardian red brick buildings, and long may they last. And we've also got a bit of Art Deco. If we look here where we're sitting, you see the ceilings are very much in the Deco style. The front of this building as well, with its ship-like rail at the top, as though you're standing on
that's
a ship.
Right.
And then, of course, the rotunda, as they call it, or the rainbow room.
Yes.
Very much in the Deco style. Yeah. Not everybody's cup of tea, but a lot of people do like it, so not too much to say about that. But I'm just saying that there is a variety of architectural styles. But then if we go back to the beginning and we go to the stable yard, which not many people know about, and the water tower at the back of the property. Still there. It's still there. Both the water tower and the stables and the yard. The stable yard is marked by its werfmuur, which is yard wall.
Yeah.
Very detailed. Also beautiful teak gates with big strap hinges. There's one gate, I think, that's left there now. I'll show you on the way out.
Yeah.
And the stables are still there as well. Now, these stables were, of course, for people who came to the club. Remember, when the club in 1906 started, cars were very few and far between.
Exactly.
So the horses were very much still the mode of transport. Whether that was horseback, people rode here, or they had little...
This was quite a horsey area in any case.
That's right. They had to be. I mean, how else did you get here? There were no buses or anything in 1906. So people came by fly or scotch cart or whatever it was. And they had to have place for the horses to be fed and to be looked after, and this is what the stables were for. Also, as I mentioned earlier, they had gymkhanas here.
Yeah.
And again, they had to provide for space for the horses. Also hunting and that kind of thing. So the stables were absolutely essential part of the club. And we would like to see those stables resuscitated in some way. At the moment, they're just using them. Well, actually, not even using them. They were used for a bit of storage and so on. And I see one of the stables, there's a set of rails. So they must have had some kind of trolley that they used in that stable. I don't know what it was for. Can't imagine what it was for.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's there. And then the water tower, of course, this water tower is right on a high stand. It must be maybe 10 or 15 meters high. And that, I think, recalls the days when they had to pump the water from the stream, and that provided the pressure that was necessary for the gardens and for the buildings as well. Otherwise, it would have been, you know, too low, the pressure. So those features are still there. I just wanted to mention that at the Parkdown Convent, now the Holy Family College, there was a similar water stand, water tank on a stand, and that was just last year or the year before demolished. And I might add unlawfully, because it was a 60-year-old structure, more than 60 years. They certainly didn't have a permit to do that. So I just hope that this one stays. I mean, you know, if it's important now to some people like me, you know, heritage enthusiasts, now, in 100 years' time, it'll be very important about everybody.
Exactly.
It just gets more and more important.
Pinpointer now. Like you say, like that stand or like that, like those hinges, I mean, we wouldn't know unless they were around to
That's
see.
Right. Exactly.
We would have no reference.
That's the point. Okay, and now if we can move on to talk a little bit about the streams. I just want to point out that there are three streams in this area.
Yeah.
There is the Braamfontein Spruit, which rises up in Berea, Bernardi Park School, and then runs down westerly in a westerly direction through the Peter Lewis Park into Frank Brown. The second stream is what we call the Gasworks Spruit, which rises in the Braamfontein Cemetery.
Okay.
And the third one is this one that runs through the property here. Remember, this was the stream that fed the dam on Lindeke's farm.
Yes. Yeah.
Or Bezodna's farm,
yes,
whichever version you believe. But Wendy Bodman is a woman who wrote a monograph on... Mm-hmm. On the north flowing streams of the Witwatersrand.
Oh, I see.
And she refers to the stream, and she says the stream rises on this property. But I think she may be wrong there. I think it rises on Brixton Ridge and drains the whole of that ridge.
Okay.
Because if we go and look at it, you'll see it's running quite hard as it gets onto the property. So unless there's a fountain there, that you know, an eye that bubbles up, I think it actually comes from Brixton. And I'd love to find out, but I'm not quite sure how one would do that. And anyway, these three streams then converge and they form, you know, they come form a confluence down just below St. Susie. And that's where the Amawasha were, did their washing. The Dobies, the Indians, who had done this for years in Durban on the Umgeni River.
Yeah.
And the Zulu washermen who learned from the Dobies and came up to Johannesburg to take over the work of the women that weren't here. So that's the stream is very important. It did eventually form the lake at the country club where people did their punting and their rowing. Is there time for a little anecdote about that?
Yeah, we got a little bit of time. Yeah.
Okay, one of the things is that there was a sort of unwritten rule that you may not go out onto the lake at night. But, you know, people sometimes did. And people used it as a kind of romantic walk around the lake. You had to go in a certain direction. You mustn't go in the other direction, otherwise you'd bump into people going here. But certainly you weren't allowed out on the lake. And one of the stories that is told is of Mr. Brierley, who was the porter at the club. And he was an ex-British Army soldier, very upright and forthright. And he found a young couple entwined in an embrace on a punt on the lake. And he pulled the punt in. And he, you know, he told him, you have a choice now. You come straight with me to the secretary of the club, or you leave. And they chose to leave, of course, because you didn't want to confront Colonel Dawson Squibb. But when Brierley reported to Dawson Squibb, his indignation was palpable. And he said to Dawson Squibb, "And what was worse, sir, was that the man was not even a member of the club, sir." So those were the days.
And with that, you're going to have to end off our sort of episode.
Yeah, well, there's still plenty more to talk about
at
the club.
Exactly, and when we come back with our program, we don't know when exactly that will be. We'd love to continue.
Good.
And thank you so much for all these delightful
chats
that we've been having.
Yeah, they've been good. I've enjoyed it.
And now let's go and listen to a track called Rickshaw Riding, probably less known by the Bats and Paul Litchfield.
From the house doctor to the rock professor, today's groundbreakers are here on Radio Today.
Switch on to 1485 AM Radio Today.
Because that's where you find us. It's Marie-Le Emond and Alistair Graham. The studio, today's called Melville.
I'm going to carry on from that. Oh boy. Well, the way we have to carry on there is to tell you about the Banvue Farmers Market on Saturday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. And then of course Melville Copies on the 20th, Sunday, 2 p.m. That's a 3-hour guided walk on Melville Copies Central. I'm sure everybody knows about that by now, so I'm not going to go into a lot of details except to tell you that that's where you'll learn everything about the copies. And then of course the Lighthouse. Are you going to cough or...
Susie, no, I'm not.
You're about to.
No, promise.
The Lighthouse. Monday night, comedy night. Tuesday night, documentary screening and talks. Wednesday night is drama night. Thursday night, artist night. Friday night, good food night. They've got a Facebook site as well, so you can always go there and find out exactly what's on.
Yeah, it's, that's updated every day. Yeah.
And Love Box?
Wow, nice stuff. There's Hazel Crampton, whose people will know her from having launched a book about 3 years ago called The Sunburnt Queen. Now, she's one of those writers, sort of comes on from Ryder Haggard, I suppose, who is very interested in white women among black tribes. And she's done a lot of research. The story about the little Bessie, the little girl, was probably true. That was in the Sunburned Queen, and now she's got a new book out, and it's called The Side of the Sun at Noon, and it's called A Quest.
That sounds fascinating.
Now, one. When Van Riebeck landed, he was actually told about a tribe called the Chobona, and he sent some people into the hinterland to go and investigate them, and I think she's based this book on that. Whether the person in the Chobona tribe was white or not is... Well, we have to read the book and see.
Okay.
But RSVP Kate at Love Books, and it's the launch is on Wednesday at 6 o'clock. And Sarki's Garage has also got something wonderful. It's called Coelacanth. It's actually a group, very, very good group, actually. They're all songwriters, three guys, all songwriters. They're all very good musicians, and they're all good singers, too. Now, that's Gareth Wilson, who's pretty well known, Jaco Mans, extremely well known, and André Creel. And their music is superb. So you'd have a superbly entertaining evening, and you'll have that lovely dinner, just 290 rand, and it's a four-course whammo. Most delicious. But again, you do have to book. There are limited seats. There are only 48 seats for these things. And you email sarkigarage@gmail.com. Then at the Bamboo on Saturday, that's at the Artists Gallery upstairs, Fiona Coleridge has got her exhibition. Now, Fiona Coleridge has been building her name as an artist sort of interested in life beginnings and life endings. And this one's definitely about beginnings, almost about fetuses in a sense. It's called Isoptra, and it's about what our life means. I mean, that little fetus, what is it really? What is it, a promise, or is it a beginning? Mm-hmm. Is it, what is it? That's what the whole exhibition examines. So pop along there on Saturday at 12 o'clock. The gallery usually opens in mid-morning, but at 12 o'clock they do a bit of a drinks and a welcome and stuff like that. So it's a good time to be there.
I see that run for a week. So if you don't...
Most of these all run for a week. Mm. Yeah. Did I say that Sarki's Garage was on Friday? I hope I did. Because if I didn't...
You just said.
Yeah, now I have.
Any more information about Melville, contact 072-305-0281. And please note, there's going to be no show next week, but the week after will be our final show. So please tune in there. That'll be, Monday the 28th of July. And we might reminisce on some of the things from the very first show. Wait with bated breath for that one. Goodbye.